Hello everyone, welcome to this stream. Press star one if you can hear me in the chat. It's always difficult when you're solo. All right, okay. So I'm sitting here with the warm and toasty notes of Nescafe Gold. If you're joining me live, you are part of the elect, my friends, and it is your calling to watch me review the Dark Lord. If you're joining me on Monday morning or at any other time, welcome, people of the future. Just know that the world is that much worse than it is right now, because of course entropy is this kind of all things decay, all things kind of degenerate over time, and that is especially true when you're living in the Kali Yuga. Now, what is this stream about? Well, before I get going, let me get a few quick shillings out of the way. Obviously, buy my courses at the Academic Agency, the Trivium. You can level up all of your skills, writing, logic, rhetoric, foundations of politics, foundations of economics. And I should tomorrow have an announcement about a new course, not one written by me, but I think it's quite an exciting one in general. More about that. It's a mystery surprise as to that new course, which should be going live tomorrow. Okay. Also buy my book, The Populist Delusion, number one bestseller in the elections and referendum column of Amazon. Buy it now. Also get a mug, join the channel. You know, the number of times people say, oh, this stream has mysteriously disappeared. It hasn't disappeared. After about a week or so, they go behind the paywall just for channel members only. How many times, folks? How many times do I have to tell people that? So the stream I did with Jay Dyer, for example, has not mysteriously disappeared. It's still there in the archive. There are only two streams in the history of this channel that have been taken down, three streams, and they were all cigar streams that were taken down, and they are available on Odyssey. If you go to my Odyssey channel, I think there was a stream on anti-Semitism with Zarathustra Serpent, which is on Odyssey. There is a stream about that Fitz woman that I did with Radlib about the whole pandemic. That was taken down, and they were taken down by YouTube, by Susan. And then there was the stream, of course, with the Mossad about Israel that I took down myself before they took it down for me. So they're all on Odyssey. Otherwise, join the channel. All right. So why are we gathered here at this late hour, the witching hour? Let us say we have known the chimes at midnight, Master Shallow. It is because the Dark Lord yet again has reared his ugly head and has done two major interviews in the past couple of weeks, one with The Economist and one with the New York Times. Now, long-time viewers of this channel will know I keep a special interest in Tony Blair, who is not simply the former Prime Minister of the UK, but is in fact a Dark Lord of tremendous power. High up in the ranks of the World Economic Forum, special advisor to the ADL. The Tony Blair Institute is the ghostwriter for many policies of the UK government. It is an NGO backed by the Bill and the Bill Gates Foundation. I always forget the name of his wife. Is it Melinda Gates? Bill and Melinda? Bill and Melania Gates. I can't remember. So Bill Gates has his kind of greasy fingers in the pie of Blair as well. It doesn't matter the topic. We did streams on Kazakhstan, and the Dark Lord was lurking in the background. So it's interesting now that essentially neocon war, this NATO-led effort to get everybody to support Ukraine and to think that Vladimir Putin is the second coming of the Mustache Man. It's funny now that Blair, who just 6 months ago was all about the pandemic and the vaccines and about the importance of making sure everybody takes a jab, now has to have his two pennies worth on this. And before we even get into these interviews, the first question that you should be asking is, why are these interviews published at all? Why is it that former Prime Minister Tony Blair has to intervene so often into the discourse? Why is he constantly given a platform by the likes of The Economist, The New York Times, and every other outlet of the empire of lies? Why does the man have such a prominent public profile still, when he hasn't been the Prime Minister since 2008? Questions to be asked, ladies and gentlemen, which I will let you get into my back catalogue to answer those questions, because I've done many deep dives on the Dark Lord. But it's important to note. I mean, is George W. Bush going around giving interviews like this? Is Gordon Brown going around giving interviews like this? No. I mean, once in a while, you may get a statement from John Major or George Bush or Gordon Brown or David Cameron, once in a blue moon. But Blair is ever present. He has to have his say on every major issue of the day. And so let me just explain why I do these streams. Let me just explain why I keep a close eye on what the Dark Lord is saying. The best way of seeing the Dark Lord is the point man of the WEF types, of the global ruling oligarchy, if you want, the ruling class in the UK. And also, he still acts as this intermediary between the UK and America as well. So he constantly has... Note, the New York Times is an American newspaper. He is always giving these interviews with CNN and MSNBC. So he's in the American discourse as well as the British discourse. And you have to see the pronouncements of the Dark Lord as, well, what is it that Sauron wants? Okay, he's not Sauron himself, but he's like a Saruman. He's like an agent of the true elites of this world. So let's just keep a close eye on him. Okay. Now, many people will tell you, actually, well, he's not that important. He's just a bloke. He's just a puppet. That's not true. I would warrant that Tony Blair, even now in 2022, is more powerful than both Boris Johnson and Joe Biden. Okay, he doesn't hold formal office. But, well, let's just take a listen to see what the Dark Lord has to say today. I'm going to make the screen big. And the way this is going to work, I'm going to play this interview, and then I'm going to pause it to comment as we go through. We're going to look at two interviews, first with The Economist and then with The New York Times. Are you ready? Let's go.
I knew Putin in two incarnations. Even in that second incarnation, he was brutal but calculating. My anxiety is we got a third.
Britain's former prime...
You've got to love the production, the dark music, you know.
Minister Tony Blair has met Vladimir Putin several times and knows what it's like to negotiate with him. Tony Blair sat down with The Economist editor-in-chief to give his take on how the West should deal with the...
Note, by the way, that Blair just has a direct line into the editor-in-chief of The Economist. If Blair wants... You know, a 20-minute interview with The Economist, of course, the world will stop and they will give him the top platform. Even if nobody watches, well, there's one person watching, and it's me, ladies and gentlemen, it's me.
Russian president.
He deserves to be completely defeated.
This global but divisive statesman told us Western foreign policy has lost its way.
The wake-up call to the West has been going on for a long time.
And that Western democracies must use this moment to get back on the front foot and shape the global balance of power.
Every crisis is an opportunity, right, Tony? Every crisis is an opportunity.
Tony Blair, thank you so much for joining us. So what about...
Look at the lighting, by the way. Amazing. Anyway, let's carry on.
The evolution of Vladimir Putin. I mean, you've met him and you describe how early on you thought of him as a reformer. What do you think has happened?
When I first met him, we offered a strong relationship with NATO precisely in order to allay Russian fears that, you know, NATO was about encircling Russia. Then over time, you noticed that he was removing all the democratic checks and balances.
Now, hold on. Hold on, Tony. We offered him closer relationships with NATO, and then over time, he got disillusioned. I mean, why did Putin over time turn against that idea? Because during your time as prime minister and in your deep alliance with George W. Bush, you expanded the borders of NATO continuously. It's not just accidental that Putin felt betrayed. So, I mean, look at the framing already. You dishonest bastard. Anyway, let's carry on.
In Russia, you know, I was getting reports from our intelligence people that, frankly, I didn't really take that seriously at the time, that he was accumulating the people around him massive personal wealth. And
by the way, when he talks about removing quote-unquote democratic checks and balances, what he's really talking about is the moment that Putin threw out all of the NGOs, i.e., Blairite operatives who were in Russia to undermine Putin's government, to agitate, to create subversion and discontent. Imagine in you're playing Sid Meier's Civilization, right? You've played those games, and you find out that an enemy civilization has implanted a spy in your capital. Okay, and then the opposing civilization discovers there's a spy in the capital, and then they eject that spy. Okay, because the spy was there to create discontent in the opposing capital. Is that removing a quote unquote democratic checks and balances, or is that Vladimir Putin acting in the interests of his own country? That is my counter to Blair's opening salvo here. But let's carry on. I mean, I will say, in the interest of balance, that Putin has kind of gamed the Russian system to stay in power longer than he should have. But then, so did FDR. You know. So I mean. while we're on the subject of democratic checks and balances, let us not forget, who was the most autocratic leader of the Great Britain since World War II? It was Tony Blair, the least accountable. He famously led Westminster from a very close-knit group where he kept out members of the cabinet. Do you remember those secret meetings he had with Alistair Campbell and Peter Mandelson and his little close crew? You know, he wouldn't even let cabinet members in on the decision-making process. And he's got the audacity to say that, Putin is removing democratic checks and balances. Anyway, let's continue.
The anxiety, I think, that everyone has now is that he has become so detached from reality that, you know, you've got a new incarnation. The worry I have now with Putin is that is he capable of thinking rationally about this in a way that anyone else outside of that closed bubble that he inhabits?
I mean, the sheer fucking gall and irony of this as well. Putin doesn't live in reality and he cannot see outside of his own bubble, says Tony Blair, representative of one of the most closeted elites who live entirely in their own bubble, who don't listen to anyone else, who deal in unreality on a daily basis. Notice, I mean, it's Binary Surfer who always says it's always projection with the left. But this is, look at this projection. You know, it's Putin who doesn't live in reality and who lives in the bubble, and it's all of his guys who live in reality and don't live in a bubble. But in fact, the exact opposite is the case. Putin has been the one who's been dealing in reality, realpolitik, and so on. And it has been the NATO, the ruling class, who can't really see outside of their own arseholes at the moment. This is obvious for the world to see. And if you look at the way that the geopolitical order is lining up behind this, it's becoming ever more obvious that it is this neoliberal ruling class that Tony Blair represents who are the ones in the bubble, not Vladimir Putin. But let's carry on.
Can relate to.
The war in Ukraine was a wake-up call for the West. Was it a wake-up call for you too, or did you see this coming?
No, I didn't foresee this. But I think the wake-up call to the West has been going on for a long time. So even if we couldn't be sure what he was going to do, the West, in my view, has been essentially in retreat for over a decade. You know, this is a problem for us, and we've got to deal with it.
So let's talk about this Western retreat. There's lots of reasons for that, but one reason I think that many give is that it is essentially a legacy of Western overreach, particularly the war in Iraq. Do you think that the war that many people think was disastrous and illegal, the invasion of Iraq, has reduced appetite in the West for military intervention? And indeed, did it embolden and strengthen Vladimir Putin?
Good question from The Economist, to be fair.
Putin.
I don't think it emboldened or strengthened him. Whether you agreed or disagreed with the military action, we removed Saddam Hussein, removed the Taliban in order to replace it with a democratic process. Compare and contrast that with Putin. He went into...
He did not... He just didn't answer that question, did he? He said, whether you agree or disagree with it, we removed Saddam Hussein and tried to put in democracy instead. Now, let's contrast that with Putin. I mean, it's just... anyway, let's continue.
Syria, to prop up a dictator, there were chemical weapons used against the Syrian population by Assad. We took no.
I mean, that's a lie. We know that was yet another WMD special lie that NATO put out, that Assad used chemical weapons on children against his own population in the middle of a civil war and a crisis. Assad, for no reason at all, just unleashed chemical weapons on his own population. Yeah, brilliant
action. So I think that's what he sees.
Vladimir Putin is rightly, you know, his invasion has been called a crime of aggression, but you know, many people called the Iraq invasion a crime of aggression. It didn't have UN sanctions. You hear this, you hear that the West has double standards. What do you say to that?
I think what we've got to do is punch back very hard when people come at us with this.
Okay. I mean, look, this is why I tell you he is correct. I mean, if you want an insight into the way these people think, here it is. Punch back very hard when people say this. So let's hear his punch back.
Okay, you may disagree with what was done, but compare getting rid of a brutal dictatorship and trying to replace it with a democracy. Okay, you can say that it was a flawed effort and there were failures attached to it, but that was, as it were, something supported, by the way, by the Iraqi people when they turned out to vote in the election.
Yeah. The Iraqi people supported it. he's basically just tripling down. He's just saying, listen, when we go and invade countries, it's for democracy. And that's good, because dictators are bad and democracy is good. And so when we go and do wars, offensive wars in this way, it's justified. Whereas when Putin does it, because Putin is a dictator and he's evil, and because the darling Zelensky represents quote unquote liberal democracy, therefore it's bad. Friend good, enemy bad. This is just pure Carl Schmitt, just from the point of view of a globalist.
Compare and contrast that with literally invading a country that's no threat to you whatever, and a country that's never proved any problem for anyone. Come on.
What happened in Afghanistan last year, the nature of US withdrawal, isn't there an argument that that could have emboldened Vladimir Putin because he thought he would get away with it?
Yeah, sure, it did, but the point is we didn't need to do it. We could have stayed there and we could have helped the country over.
we shouldn't have withdrawn from Afghanistan. Exactly. There we go, Tony. Look, Tony's like, you didn't need, you let the Taliban back in. The Taliban that we destroyed 10 years ago, who are back, you let them back in. So, you know, shouldn't have withdrawn, should have stayed in Afghanistan indefinitely. So, I mean, from the point of view of empire, of course, he is correct. From the point of view of like pure power, it was probably a mistake to withdraw, like from his project's point of view, from the neocon project, the withdrawal from Afghanistan. You know, he's probably right on that. They probably should have stayed there. Senseless though it was, if you're going to do it, you might as well see it through. Because what America have done instead, which is withdrawing and giving the Taliban a massive victory, has made them look like weak, and it's made them look pathetic, to be honest. So, I mean, from their point of view, he's actually correct here. So let's carry on.
For a longer period of time. Now, of course, but that goes to the point right round the world you see this. I mean, my institute does a lot of work in Africa. You see all over Africa.
That's an interesting point, by the way. Tony Blair is not only the point man for Great Britain and let's just say UK-US relations. He is also their point man down in Africa for reasons nobody knows. I mean, but he oversees you have to see Blair as a kind of, I don't know what you call it, like an emissary, he's an overlord of their, you know, like in a corporation where people get portfolio. Blair's portfolio has Africa in it. Again, reasons we don't know. But Tony Blair, for example, was in charge of like vaccinating half of Africa. Don't know how well that went, but he was in charge of it.
The influence now of China and now increasingly of Russia. The West is slow, it's bureaucratic, it doesn't work out how to build the right relationships. And yet many of these countries would prefer a relationship with America, with Western countries. So my point is a very simple one. It's that if the West wants to get back on the front foot, it's got to do a number of things that are really important. And they're all linked together by one concept, which is strategy. You've got to have a strategic, long-term view of the West and its place in the world. If you do that, then all the other things can flow from that, and you can get back on the front foot again.
Richard Spencer is jacking off somewhere to this. He's like, yes, yes, yes.
Can there be a lasting peace with Putin in the Kremlin?
I don't know. I don't think no one's going to believe any commitments that he gives, any assurances that he gives. And I do think out of this will come two things. One, I think this will prove his downfall eventually. That's my guess. I'm not saying it will happen immediately, but this is, he's turned Russia into a pariah state amongst the West, at least, and crippled.
Tacit admission amongst the West, at least. Tacit admission from Tony there that the rest of the world is either staying neutral or they haven't come down on the side of the West. Very interesting it also seems like he's hedging a little bit here, because this is the globalist's wish for the downfall of Putin. It's wishful thinking on their part, but they know that they may not actually have the mechanisms or the power to remove him, and this is frustrating the gay, as it were.
His economy. But the second thing is that Ukraine will emerge as a stronger, more independent state, probably eventually a member of the European Union, I would say.
Although, so was President Biden right when he said this man must go?
Well, he was just expressing an emotional response. Look, I think most people are sitting there thinking, how can you do this? I mean, literally, how can you do this? And when the tales of these atrocities in Bucha and elsewhere come out, and you see, I mean, 2022 on the doorstep of the European Union, it's evil, actually.
But this does have
it's just the sheer gall of this man. Notice, by the way, he didn't respond to the earlier criticism of his own atrocities. He just said, oh, it was actually good when I did it. It was good when I did it. But when this dude does it, when Putin does it, it's evil. We can't believe anything he says. But if you're Russian, or if you're Putin sitting on the other side of this, he'd be saying, like, yeah, but why should anybody believe anything that you have to say, Tony? I mean, you have a track record of openly lying. He's even repeated a lie in this interview about Assad's chemical weapons, which was shown to be false. But, you know, world keeps on turning.
Sort of policy consequences. Because you can agree that it's very hard to see lasting peace with this man in the Kremlin, and also agree that regime change should not be the goal of Western policy. But what then should be the goal of Western policy vis-a-vis Putin, given where he appears to be?
You have to both ratchet up the pressure and try and get a structured negotiation and get an agreement that at least halts the hostilities. You know, he deserves to be completely defeated, but I think the longer this conflict goes on, that becomes extremely difficult. So I think I find it very hard to see how you make a deal now.
Basically admitting that Russia can't be defeated on the ground. Just admitted that. You know, we need to keep on leaning on soft power. Basically, tacit admission from Tony that the Emperor of Lies is effed up here.
Do you agree with President Zelensky that the West should be imposing tougher sanctions, particularly the Europeans, and there should be more weaponry, more offensive weaponry?
Yes, I basically agree with that. I think you've got to toughen up the sanctions. I mean, the distinction between defensive and offensive weapons capabilities at a certain point becomes a bit meaningless. They need the ability to be able to push back hard on the Russians. And that, I think, does require tanks, long-range missiles, other heavy arms.
More weapons, more death. He's just a fucking lunatic, this guy. But note, the reason we watch Blair is because he shows the innermost thinking of the regime. This is what the regime wants. Notice that all his answers have been, yes, more of what we're doing, more tanks, more missiles, more pressure, more economic sanctions, keep on going, harder, faster. There's no like reverse gear, and this is like pure neoliberal, neocon vision, of which Blair, I mean, you cut this man and he bleeds like neoliberal globalism. So it's very interesting that he's like 100% in lockstep with what is currently happening. Even though it's obviously not working, he's like, yeah, more of the same, even harder. They have no reverse gear, these people. And I mean, we've been watching them for many years now. I actually believe that Tony Blair is completely insane at this point. Because I actually think no part of him doesn't believe in this thing that he's saying at the moment. Just completely possessed. But this is what you need, like the acolyte of darkness here. Let's carry on.
Artillery.
Are Europeans insufficiently prepared to suffer themselves for this? I mean, do you think there is a sense of the stakes?
Well, there will be some anxiety, but we all are going to suffer some short-term pain. Look, Europe has come together in a pretty remarkable way, but we're going to have to go further. And the risk, the principal risk now, is escalation, because if you can't find a way to bring the conflict to an end, and it's clear that Putin is going to struggle to win this militarily, the question is, how desperate does he become?
What's your assessment of President Zelensky and his leadership of this war effort and his ability to, you know, harness, in some sense, the spirit of Ukraine so powerfully globally?
You know, this was a defining moment for him, and he did something that was both incredibly brave and...
I mean, yeah, the Europeans are just going to have to take 30% fucking inflation for this insane war. We're prepared to come together, you know, blitz spirit and all of that. By the way, Tony, tell me how great Vladimir Zelensky is. Oh, yeah, he's a great guy. It's a defining moment for him. Brilliant. Send them another $30 billion.
And obviously, extraordinarily powerful as a drawing together of people under the banner of democracy.
Let's talk a bit about the longer term consequences of this. Do you think this is a defining moment for the West and for sort of global geopolitical balances of power?
It is a wake-up call for the West, but it should make us think very carefully about what we need to do for the future. And that's why I say it's about strategy. You know, we need to build our defense capabilities. We need to make sure that we are building our alliances. The transatlantic alliance has got to be revived and made strong, I mean, really strong. We have got to have a coherence of policy across the piece so that, you know, those people who are our allies, we're standing with them, we're helping them. But above all else, we should have confidence in our own system. And, you know, we haven't, you know, the politics.
Why don't we have confidence in our own system, I wonder? 81 million vote Joe Biden. Yeah.
So the US has, in the last years, has been, you know, to be honest, it's been a mess. And it's been a problem.
I mean, there is a, you know, a non-negligible possibility that Donald Trump wins the election in 2024. So can you be sure about, you know, the US being where it is right now in terms of its position on Ukraine and Putin?
Look, we'll have to accept whatever the US decides to do. I mean, his people elect him. I mean, I have no idea whether that will happen or not, or whether he's even going to stand. But the point is, whoever is the president, I think after what has happened, whoever...
Now, this is significant now, right? Notice that Tony Blair, and notice what I've been saying. If you read my last Substack article on containment, I've been saying the Empire of Lies, is setting up for the possibility of a normalized second Trump presidency, okay? I think they've realized that this Joe Biden administration has been a disaster, and that in order to win a lot of people back and to restore their faith in the regime may involve accepting Trump, okay? And Trump will bring millions of people back into the fold to keep on fighting the forever wars. Okay, I've been, people don't believe me. I've been saying this for some months now, that the system is gearing up for Trump again. But this Trump will be a normalized, contained Trump, not the Trump of 2015. It will be a kind of Trump of the regime as a containment vehicle in order to win support back for NATO, for the West as a bloc, as against Russia and so on. The fact that Tony Blair here didn't say, oh, that would be a disaster for democracy, that would be terrible if Trump came back, is very telling. Because, as I keep on saying, Trump, Blair is extremely close to all of these major players. You know, the Larry Finks and the ADLs and the, you know, the World Economic Forums and so on. He is like one of them. He thinks that at that top level strategic line. Okay, and he's come out and said we need to put this woke thing away. He said Blair has said that in the past. This is Blair basically just accepting, well, Trump could be the president, and that's fine. That's fine. We still need to carry on doing the bidding of the Empire of Lies, and if that involves bringing Trump in, so be it. We bring Trump in. They will always back themselves, by the way, to control any strongman. I mean, if you go back in history, they backed themselves to control even Joseph Stalin back then. And when he turned on them, that's when they turned on him. So I honestly think that there are moves afoot within the deep American state to set up for this second Trump presidency, where it's going to be like, okay, he's going to be the president again, but this time he's going to be on our side. Mark my words, this is going to happen. And many people watching this will cheer it on and will move away from dissident spheres when that happens. I'm just calling out the gays play before it happens, but always pay attention to Blair's answers. He has reconciled to the fact that Trump might be president again, and he doesn't care.
Where is the president is going to recognize that they need to build strong alliances, you know, irrespective of what's been said in the past. So I'm not too worried about that, no matter what happens.
And the second part of your strategy was building the alliances more broadly. But if you look at countries from India to Saudi Arabia to the UAE to large numbers of countries in Africa, they have not been part of this anti-Putin alliance. They have not really come out in support of Ukraine in any meaningful way.
I have to say, this editor-in-chief of The Economist has told more truth in her questions than you might imagine. She hasn't really grilled him. She's let his slippery, lizard-like answers go. But her initial questions have been quite good, to be fair to her. You know, she could have been a bit of a tougher interviewer, but, you know, let's not forget that these are all Blair puff pieces, basically. So let's see what he says.
I think it's a spur to us to think strategically. Look, if you're India, got Pakistan next door to it, it's got China, which is a constant presence on its border with skirmishes. You know, if you're India, you need to build your defense capability. So maybe we should be asking the question of why have the Indians gone to Russia and not...
I mean, he's literally saying, we need to be selling them those weapons, not Russia. It should be my friends getting the defense contract. It's literally what you're saying.
And not come to us. And then when you look at the Middle East, if you're one of the...
You should have come to us, Modi. You should have come to us. You know, we only pissed you off by insisting that you follow Greta Thunberg and, you know, do all the environmental climate change bollocks and all the woke shit. And, you know, that's what happened. They pissed off Modi with all of their other shite. And that's why it pushed India towards Russia. It's obvious what happened. Now he's like, oh, you should have come to us, India. We got all the tanks and the bombs and the weapons. Come to us.
Middle East countries at the moment, you're thinking your big threat is Iran. And are we really helping stand up to that threat or not? And in Africa, you know, as I say, the fact is if you're in the Sahel group of countries, you see Russia moving in there. I mean, the Sahel group of countries is a group of countries.
Moving into Africa, my patch. What is Vladimir Putin doing there? It should be us. But of course, from the point of view of the empire, Blair is entirely correct. As is so often the case, the kind of leaders at the moment aren't actually making a lot of the moves that they should be doing if they want to make the empire as strong as possible. You know, whatever you make of Blair, he is a robust strategist and he is a serious kind of, I hesitate to use the word thinker, but he's very serious about making the gay as strong as possible. And he's right that they have let this slip. You know, they should be keeping Russia out of Africa. They should, you know, and China out of Africa. They should be there. You know, it's his patch. So he's very, very aware of these moves on the ground. And Russia does have all sorts of very interesting security deals in Africa. A typical deal that they make in Africa is it'll be like, okay, diamond extraction. The Chinese will put up the money to help get your diamonds out. The Russians will come in and basically give you a mercenary militia group for security. That's how it typically works down there. It's be like, okay, Russia makes sure that your assets are safe. China gives you the investment so that you've got the capital to get it, to get the diamonds out. They've done it in country after country. It's the 1-2 shot. It's the Russia-China combo. It's always the same. Russia gives the weapons. Russia gives the security personnel. They give they give military training. China stumps up the cash, basically. Cash that they got from the West, of course.
It's where it's absolutely vital for the West to be seen to act and to be acting against this jihadist extremism and all the problems that, that those countries have. If we don't act, by the way, we're going to get floods of migration from those countries and big problems of extremism.
There you go. And it's like Blair is intensely aware, by the way, of the political utility of using immigration. Notice he brought up immigration from Africa, using immigration as a leverage point to get what he wants ultimately. This is why Blair, by the way, is a far more sophisticated political player than some of the ideologues in the Democratic Party, like Elizabeth Warren, for example, who are like, oh no, we must go full steam ahead with immigration all the time. Blair's like, no, I understand that people don't like immigration, so let's make a set of promises, or let's use the fear of immigration to drive policy that we want. Of course, they'll still bring in hundreds of thousands. This was a twat who set up the mass immigration in the first place, but that doesn't mean that he doesn't see the utility of using the fear of immigration to, you know, to drive policy.
But we're not there.
So Xi Jinping is often thought of as having a strategy and a much bigger, longer term vision for China's rise. This partnership with Russia now, and the very clear decision that he has made not to criticize Russia, does it mean we're going to be in a kind of alliance of autocracies, or how do you see that?
Well, again, it's one of the things I've learned since leaving office is how important it is not to see this always from a Western point of view. And, you know, from the Chinese point of view, they regard themselves, and indeed are, a major, major power. They look after their own interests. If China believes that the West is irretrievably hostile and is looking to disengage, to leave China alone, to put it, as it were, to the side, I don't think that's possible or sensible. But if they think that, then of course they've got no interest in alienating Russia, because they want to pull Russia into their orbit. China's not going to allow Russia to determine policy. I mean, Russia will be the very junior partner in this relationship. So we've also got to take a complete view. What is our...
This is basic. This is true, this analysis that he gave, by the way. 100% true, everything you just said.
Relationship with China going to be? That is the defining question of 21st century geopolitics. We can't be sure whether in the future it's going to be merely a competitor, or, as most people I think in the West now think, it's going to be our opponent, and possibly even, according to some people, our enemy.
Does that mean that you think the West's current strategy towards China is the wrong one?
The West has got to be strong enough militarily to do whatever is necessary to deal with whatever comes out of China. But you've also got to understand that...
notice everything. We must increase defense spending across the board, more weapons, more tanks, always. In a sense, he's correct, but also don't forget he's driving towards the EU, Europe, the EU military, the EU army. This is ultimately what he's got in mind as well, when it comes to these things.
Divorcing ourselves from China, not engaging, I don't think it's either possible or sensible. You've got to understand a power like China. You've got to be in a position where lines of communication remain open. I understand why you don't want economic interaction on technology or companies with a security impact. But other than that, is it really sensible for us to separate, to decouple from China? I don't think so.
So is this lack of strategy, why is it that there isn't the kind of strategic approach that you're advocating right now?
I think politics has become much, much harder, because if you want to pursue a strategy, that's long term. And to pursue it effectively, it's got to be consistent over a period of years.
Sounds like the real problem is democracy itself, eh, Tony? It's democracy that's the problem. That's what he's saying.
What's happened in the politics of the West over these past years, there's been this, you know, surge of populism. There's been splintering off to the far right, to the far left.
What will it take for this ghastly invasion and its aftermath to be the catalyst, if you will, for the kind of rethinking, strategic rethinking that you're calling for?
I'm horrified by what's happening in Ukraine, but long term out of this, I think what's happened demonstrates the value of a liberal democracy, and it also will stimulate, I believe, a revaluation from the West of how it positions itself. And my hope is, within our internal politics in the West, you know, that populism that I think has done a huge amount of damage to our position and our standing is in retreat. So the long-term prospects for liberal democracy, I think, have been amply demonstrated as positive.
I hope you're right. Tony Blair, thank you very much indeed. Thanks.
So there we go. So that was the first interview. Let's put all this politics away. The real problem is that my guys, the centre, are not permanently in control. That's what he said at the end. Basically, we can't have a real left and a real right in democracy because it hampers long-term strategic planning. So instead, what you need is a permanent oligarchy of people like Tony Blair to do, you know, managerial fusion between international finance and government, as embodied in a man like Tony Blair, to do the thinking instead. That's really what he was saying at the end there, if you read between the lines. Now, and I'm not actually suggesting that he's 100% wrong when it comes to that, because it is a problem that you don't have consistent long-term strategy across various administrations, and you know that is a problem that the West has, because America can't see through any project. I mean, it's just if you look at the mess they made in Iraq and Afghanistan, they don't see anything through. I mean, whether you agree or disagree with what the policies are, and obviously most of us disagree with those policies, you at least have to see them through. But of course, they can't do that because, you know, they have to keep on playing this this game of appeasing voter bases and so on. So, let us watch the second one now. I'll just take a quick break to cover any super chats that have come in so far. And then we'll watch the second one, which is with the New York Times. Okay. Sensum Cominium says, thank you for the cigar recommendation earlier. Also, will you be narrating an audiobook version of The Populist Delusion? Take care and all the best to the family. There will be an audiobook of The Populist Delusion, but I will not be the narrator. I can tell you that for certain. And that is for the best. Trust me. I am not the best. I am the only person who is good at reading their own books is Peter Hitchens, and not because he's a good narrator, but because he's so like grumpy during those recordings. So if you get a chance to listen to the audiobook version of The Abolition of Britain, I strongly recommend that. But I actually think it's for the best that I won't be the one narrating it. Chris Primer says, the UK needs a man of action with a grand vision, someone with experience who can speak to the hearts of the people and awaken their senses. Hail Tony! Hugh James says, TB was also interviewed on Times Radio on YouTube. Interesting. So there's another interview. I haven't got that one lined up. Maybe it'll have to be a future edition of Dark Lord Watch when I watch that. Parmesan Valjean says, love the movements of the Dark Lord segments, sinister stuff. And the Enriab says, Blair doesn't tell you what he thinks, he tells you what he wants you to think. Yes, and Tony Blair will also always back himself to change your mind. He'd be like, oh, you didn't really think that. Here's what you really think if you were sensible, you know. And he's always framed it in that way. Okay, and there's one last one come in, and then we'll start with the New York Times stream. So Maimondiz Nuts says, AA, you will find funny the US Army Service ribbon being the participation trophy of the army. Please look up the actual image of the ribbon. U.S. Army Service ribbon. Let's have a look then. Is it a rainbow? It's a rainbow. Is that it? Is that what we're... It is actually a rainbow. Look. Is it literally a pride flag? Is that right? Okay, there we go then. All right, let us now watch the second.
Hi there, welcome, and thank you for...
Now, this one is a bit quiet, and I cannot increase the volume any louder, so you may want to... maybe I'll sit back a bit further from my mic so that we're in line. But you may want to turn up your volume a little bit for this next bit.
For joining us here at the New York Times, I'm Peter Baker. I'm the chief White House correspondent. We have with us today Tony Blair, the former Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. We're very lucky to have him to help us understand and put into context a lot of the news we're seeing out of Europe these days. Prime Minister, thank you very much.
Can I get a background check on this journalist, by the way? Who is he? What's his background? Wikipedia entry, please.
Thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you, Peter.
Now, I know we've got a lot of ground to cover in a very short amount of time. We're going to jump right into it. Everybody, of course, is talking about the war in Ukraine. That's the central fixation, obviously, of many people in the world right now. Just last week, the American Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said that the goal of the West now is not just to simply stop the invasion of Ukraine, but to weaken Russia in a broader sense so that they can't do this kind of thing again. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about whether you think that's a good idea to broaden the aims like that. And some of our readers, we're going to have them, they're adding questions. Avi from Tampa and Mouncy from Virginia want to know, how do we do that without an escalation that could lead to something worse, like a nuclear confrontation?
So I think it depends on what we mean by it. I think this misadventure of Putin's will weaken Russia. I think it will make Russia much less capable. I mean, simply because of all the equipment and troops they've lost in the course of it, it will make them much weaker. But I think our ambition has got to be to defeat Russia's aggression in Ukraine, mm-hmm. and to secure a Russian retreat from what they've done, which the Ukrainian president and people will accept. I think it's best to have that ambition. Will it weaken Russia in the medium and longer term? Yes, for sure. But I think our ambition's got to be related to Ukraine.
Do we want a weaker Russia? Is that overall a positive thing from the point of view of the West, given his extra border adventures the way he's now?
Well, it's obviously in the interest of the West to make sure he is disinclined to do this ever again. Mm-hmm. Because it's been, I mean, it's an extraordinary act of unprovoked aggression, right? Here we are on the doorstep of the European Union, essentially Europe.
Unprovoked aggression, yeah.
European country. My institute has a project in Ukraine, so I've literally, virtually every year since I left office, gone to Ukraine every year. You meet a whole young...
Why has Tony Blair been in the Ukraine almost every single year since he left office? Question to be asked. By his own admission, I would love somebody to find out what Tony Blair was doing in Ukraine every single year since he left office.
Cadre of really smart, capable young...
Remember, unprovoked aggression. So why is the Dark Lord in Ukraine?
Ukrainians. I mean, it was never even thinkable that they were going to allow Russia to come in and topple a democratically elected president and change their country.
Right.
Let's not forget, by the way, that that NATO overthrew a democratically elected president in 2014. And installed some other dude, and then gay op Zelensky in through the backing of a billionaire. We just leave out these details because they're inconvenient. And of course, this dipshit doesn't ask any questions either.
One of the biggest economic shifts that we're seeing from the war, and may see even more so, is energy production, right? And this is going to affect people's thinking about the dependence of Europe on Russian energy, on the dependence on fossil fuels. Hal in Toronto is asking, what does this transition mean, and does it mean that we're simply going to rely on a different set of autocratic countries that have large deposits of other sources of energy like lithium, copper needed for batteries, things like that? Are we simply shifting from one set of bad actors to another?
So, I mean, you've got regimes that are autocracies. They're not democracies, but they may not pose any external threat. Mm. And then you've got an autocracy like Putin's that plainly does. So sometimes...
Autocracies that don't pose an external threat, like Iraq or like Syria, for example. Yes. Oh.
Sometimes inevitably you will be dealing with countries that aren't democracies. But the energy transition in Europe is going to be...
Dealing with autocracies that... Democracy and standing up for liberal democracy is much less important if the autocracy is a friend, is basically what you just said. Brilliant.
Very real. It's very urgent. We should have done it after Crimea. I mean, I remember at the time arguing, actually having conversations with people in the Obama administration about it. I think there was a desire to do this, but then, you know, as happens in politics, things moved on and we didn't. But the reason why we've now got such one of the problems we have in fighting this aggression is the dependence mm-hmm. of Europe on gas and the fact that we, you know, to be clear, we're still paying a large amount of money to Russia every day yeah. in return for their gas and their oil. Now, Europe is taking, they're taking strong action. And for a lot of these European countries, some of them are more than 50% dependent on Russian energy. So,
which shows you that it's a stupid move, does it not? It shows you how stupid what they're doing is. Also, I saw this in a headline the other day, which said that the EU have set a deadline when they're going to stop buying, they're going to start boycotting Russian gas. You know, they've set it for like some date in the future. I mean, how stupid is that? You know, if you're Russia and you're like, oh, these people we're selling gas to, they're going to boycott us at this day. I mean, why wouldn't they just turn off the gas right now? I mean, it's like these people don't understand leverage. They don't have leverage or power in this situation. So this is one of the most stupid elements of this whole ordeal. Is the element of the gas. They can't reroute it. There's no alternative provider of that gas. And, you know, because they didn't invest in nuclear energy, places like Germany are just fucked. They're just absolutely buggered. So, you know, 30% increase in German producer goods. Why? It's because of all of this. So, and yet, you know, he's like, oh, yeah, we need to do it for the spirit. You know, we need to do it for Ukraine.
So they're moving from that and seeking new markets at an incredible speed and with a certain amount of internal economic pain. But it will be one of the things that for sure continues.
Well, I think it's one of these things that Americans may not fully understand how much pain it means for Europeans, because Americans don't really rely on Russian energy to a substantial extent.
Oh, right. I mean, the thing with America is one of the extraordinary things about your country is you've become, you know, the biggest energy source in the world. But for a country like Germany, for example, over 40% of its gas comes right. from Russia. Now, you're already facing a cost of living crisis virtually all over Europe. You've got rising prices, rising inflation. You put into that then a gas shortage. No, this is difficult. But the good thing, and this is, you know, to be fair, I think President Biden's done a great job in assembling a Western coalition. And that coalition's strong, and in Europe, and I think...
How's that a good thing? Oh, yeah, you know, that's all terrible. You know, record inflation, rising cost of living, terrible pain. But the good thing is that we've got a coalition. What? So somehow he's less on form here when he's talking to this New York Times guy, because he's not even making sense. How is that good?
Ursula von der Leyen, the Commission President, other European leaders have done a really good job in bringing Europe together. And, okay, you know, you can say, well, they have to go further and do more, and I think they will go further and they will do more, but what they've done up to now has been a pretty impressive display of solidarity.
Well, in fact, it's encouraged even more unity in Europe in the face of Russian aggression, as Finland and Sweden think about joining NATO, which they had never done during the Cold War for all those years. And
absolutely.
Yeah.
Finland and Sweden joining NATO, Ukraine definitely now wanting a European...
I mean, great, we could all drown together. Brilliant. You know, we have to take, I was in the petrol station the other day. I have to tell this story because it made me laugh so much, right? There was a guy in front of me, white van driver, and he was like, oh, you know, packet of Camels. He was buying a pack of fags, basically. So he was picking up these cigarettes, and the guy behind the counter said, any petrol? He said, oh, no, thanks. I'm trying to give it up. it just made me laugh because he was buying cigarettes, and usually you want to try to give up smoking, not petrol. But anyway, funny little moment. But if a white van driver is saying things like that, the situation is bad. The situation is very bad, and it seems to be getting worse and worse. Yet it's all worth it because, quote unquote, countries are coming together. This is weak. This is weak sauce. And if this is the best that the Empire of Lies is coming up with, maybe there could be significant turmoil on the horizon. Because the pain hasn't really hit yet. When it really starts to hit, when people are having to decide between heating and food, or, when people aren't able to get to work anymore because petrol is too expensive, the shit will hit the fan. Whether these people like it or not, but you know, it's all worth it because Finland want to join NATO. I mean, what you know, Finland is 100% reliant on Russian gas, or at least I saw a graphic saying that. I remember somebody saying that they've decreased that dependency now, and it's more like 70%. Putin could make the Finns starve overnight if he wanted to. He could make Finland starve. So the fact that these people, like, quote, want to join NATO. Remember in the previous interview, Blair said that Putin is no longer operating in reality and he's living in a bubble. What about the bubble that this bullshit, that these two arseholes talking here are living in? Anyway, let's carry on.
Perspective, I think other countries, Moldova, which is obviously in a very delicate position now, also wanting European Union membership. You've got Serbia, Albania, North Macedonia, other countries in the Balkans and Eastern Europe wanting to join.
Now, President Trump, of course, made a big point of pushing European members of NATO to up their defense spending. He used a sledgehammer as he did so. But does he have a point in that sense? Readers Kent from Cleveland and Lenore from New York asked, you know, does this need to change the amount of European investment in their military and their defense spending? And Ronald from Switzerland asked, at the same time, I'm compiling questions here, but do international institutions like NATO need more power, and how would that be achieved?
The answer is yes, for sure. Europe's going to have to up its spending. I mean, Germany's made a huge announcement on it.
Note, by the way, that it was Donald Trump who wanted Europe to increase their spending. How many years ago was that? It was Trump who used to say that. Now they're all saying it. Very interesting, that, isn't it? Very interesting indeed.
Yes, future defence commitments. Britain will spend more as well. I think there's going to be a ramping up of European capability. And, you know, NATO's going to be... My assessment is NATO is going to be examining every dimension of what it's doing in order to improve capability. So this is a big change.
Of course, maybe we're getting answers to some question that Thomas 77 has been asking for a long time. Why does NATO exist? Period. What is the raison d'etre of NATO? And I guess that both Blair and Richard Spencer are correct, in so much as Putin has kind of renewed a reason for NATO existing in the first place, which is basically to oppose Russia. And that was Putin's point when he started this war. If you remember when he gave the Empire of Lies speech, he told a story about how NATO had continuously just flicked him and flicked him and flicked him and pushed him out and basically refused to give Russia a seat at the table, because NATO was set up to oppose the Soviet Union. So if Russia wasn't there as an enemy, NATO wouldn't have a reason to up its defense spending, to give more billions of dollars to Tony Blair and his friends. So you can see, actually, in a strange way, that they maneuvered Putin into a position where he ended up helping them out and strengthening their alliance. That has happened without doubt, but that was baked into the cake. Putin knew that when he started. He had already come to that point before the war even started. So Russia's got nothing to lose at this point.
And one of the ironies of what Putin's done is he's united Europe. He's given NATO a sense of purpose. He's got countries now lining up to join NATO, other countries lining up to join Europe, and a sense of coming together between America and Europe that hasn't been there for some years.
When you were prime minister, you were part of the effort to expand NATO. Enlargement happened a lot during the 1990s and early 2000s. A lot of debate about that right now. Was that a mistake? Was that overly provocative? Or from the point of view of Eastern Europeans who are members now, they're pretty glad, I think. But what do you think about that now? How does history look back on that?
You go to Poland and Czech Republic and say, I think it was a bad idea you guys joined NATO. I think you'd find a pretty rough reaction.
Pretty happy.
No, look, in the end, but it's very important to
You've got to love the Blair fingers. Look, he's brought out the Blair fingers. You can tell he's getting serious because he brings out the Blair fingers.
Make this clear, and Philip, I was discussing this with President Clinton a short time ago. And this is one of the strange things about what Putin has done and his own journey of change. We made every effort to make sure that Russia was not feeling that NATO...
And the blade hands, the Blair blade hands, they come out as well.
...was aiming itself at Russia. We had the partnership between Russia and NATO that we established. I remember NATO summits where first Yeltsin and I think maybe even Putin came. It wasn't the G7 at the time.
Right.
In 2005, when I headed the G7, it was actually the G8. Russia was there. So this notion that we were kind of encircling.
Now the Blair move, the steeple fingers, makes that little church with his, always got to watch the hands, friends.
And trying to put pressure on Russia and, you know, provoking them. It really isn't. It's just a misreading of history. And I think the enlargement of Europe and the enlargement of NATO was vital for these countries. By the way, if you look at a country like Poland, for all the, you know, political issues there are from time to time about it, when the Berlin Wall fell and the Soviet Union ended, Poland and Ukraine roughly the same GDP per head. Mm. Poland becoming a member of the European Union, it's now quite a wealthy country.
Right.
It's probably GDP, I don't know, probably double what Ukraine's is now. Right. I mean, this is before the
war.
Yeah.
Line go up. And that's why ultimately the Polish will accept the dissolution of their culture, of their nationhood, of their spirit, of their pride. They have to give it all up for the line to go up. More Africans for Poland.
So, no, this is, it's important to understand this Western expansion. It was never aimed at Russia. Mm-hmm. And I used to have conversations with Putin where I would say to him, look, our attitude to Russia, I remember I had a conversation with President Bush and I then said, look, I'm going to go and see him and try and clear the air because I did have a relationship. And I said to him, this notion that we're...
Look, Blair will always back himself. Listen, George, I'm in with Vlad. Me and Vlad, we go back all along. I'll change his mind. I'll do some Blair Jedi mind tricks on Putin, and you know, he'll come around to seeing our way of things. He always backs himself to change somebody else's mind. Notice that, even Vladimir Putin.
Trying to surround you, or you know, we've got a hostile intent towards Russia. I mean, we just want you guys to go and look after yourselves and do well, change your economy, make sure you're, you know, using the vast resources of the country to build a strong country. We got no problem with that. But by that time, and this is maybe, I guess, 2004, 2005, he was he was becoming absolutely obsessed by this idea. No, this is what you're trying to do. And
well, I want to talk about that. This Putin's journey of change, as you put it, is a great way to put it. Because there was this moment, I was based in Moscow for 4 years, and you would come through town. And there was this period, especially after 9/11, when there was this feeling that Putin perhaps was at least, if not an ally, at least a partner on some level. Mm-hmm. And he did allow Western troops into the former Soviet space to execute the war in Afghanistan and so forth. And then that changed. And I wonder whether you think, it often seemed to me part of that was the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. You know, that in 2003, he began to see the West in a different way. What do you think about that? You saw him, you met him repeatedly. What was he like then, and what do you think happened?
So I say to people that I knew two incarnations of Putin and the anxiety.
Another Blair move. George Bush did that as well. The thumbs, the power thumbs. This is another Blair rhetoric move you have to look out for. He's got so many of them. The Blair blades, the steeple fingers, the thumbs, and of course the Blair point as well. He uses all of these tricks all the time.
The anxiety I have is that we're in a third. Mm. The first was the guy I met just before he was prime minister and just before he became president. I remember he insisted we met in St. Petersburg, the western-facing great city in Russia. He was at that time wanting to work closely with Europe, closely with NATO. Mm-hmm. Then there was a second incarnation, which I noticed even before Iraq. I mean, I think Afghanistan and Iraq showed him, you know, that the West was prepared to use its power. But on the other hand, it's not as if either military action was aimed at Russia in any way. No, I think what changed was that his original ambition to reform the Russian economy and make it strong became too difficult. And also a whole series of vested interests grew up around.
Hold on a second. If you look at the GDP of Russia, that did actually go up massively after Putin. So that's just not true. Putin did turn around the Russian economy. He kicked out the oligarchs, your friends, Tony, who you then gave pads to in Notting Hill, you know, Roman Abramovich, you were the one who sold out London to Russian oligarchs who were kicked out by Putin. So do not give us this absolute bullshit. Putin did turn around the disastrous economy of Russia after Boris Yeltsin. You can just look at the graphs. I'm not going to pull them up now. It's just a fact. He did turn the economy of Russia around. And he showed that you don't need NATO or the West to boost GDP. So that also fires your previous argument about Poland, you know, which has become NATO aligned and therefore line must go up. Actually, it was your friends in the Ukraine who tanked the Ukrainian economy. The Ukrainian economy was actually not doing that badly. It is now basically third world. This is pre-invasion under your friends, the shithead Zelensky and the dickhead who you installed before him. So I do not accept these economic arguments from Blair about Russia. Putin, actually, the Economist and various other publications used to call it the Russian the Russian miracle, if you remember that. The real reason for Putin's journey, as Blair is calling it, is because this guy and his friend George W. Bush betrayed him. And if you watch the Oliver Stone interview with Putin, he explains exactly what happened, exactly why Putin turned, because they made him assurances that NATO would not expand, and NATO still expanded. And he said, look, if you keep on doing this, I'm going to retaliate. And that's exactly what has happened. They're not going to admit it, obviously, because don't forget, those oligarchs that Putin kicked out of Russia were their friends. And if you want the background on that, you can watch Keith Woods' video on Russia under Boris Yeltsin, and who exactly were those oligarchs, and who backed them, and whose friends were they? So this is maximum Blair gaslighting and lies in this part of this interview. Very important for you to know the facts.
Found him. There was a massive accumulation of wealth by a small number of people very close to him. And I think he then turned to nationalism. Mm-hmm. I mean, the easiest, you know, in politics, I can tell you this after 10 years as prime minister and now the work we do in many different countries in the world, working on governance and the challenge of government. And the challenge of government is always getting anything done, right? It's the biggest problem, right? And it's the challenge of democracy. The challenge of democracy is efficacy. It's allowing things to move in a fast-changing world where things get stuck. And the thing about politics is the smart thing, but the hard thing is to be a reformer, right? So if you're trying to do healthcare reform, education reform, business reform, it's all difficult, but it's the smart thing. The easy thing, but in my view, in the end, the foolish thing, is to become nationalistic, right? So in an interdependent world, you say, I'm going to stand up for my country. And that means...
Let me just stop him before he continues. This is the guy who oversaw the fucking destruction of this country. So to hear him saying this is particularly galling, because that, you know, he was the one who sold out this country to and caused problems that will never be reversed. The mass immigration problem and the demographic shift in the country is very largely down to Tony Blair's doing. If you look at the immigration numbers before Blair and after Blair, it's really, really stark. So to hear him saying, "Oh, the foolish thing to do in an interconnected world is to stand up for your own nation." If you go this route, Blair's route, actually, what happens is the abolition of your nation, as Peter Hitchens has pointed out and argued so eloquently in The Abolition of Britain. So this is adding insult to injury from where I'm standing. And actually, Putin has seen this coming down the line, and that's why he's standing up for his own nation, because he doesn't want Russia to just become, you know, yet another bloody McDonald's outpost, which is all the UK is now. So anyway, let's carry on.
You know, engaging in a type of politics that's constantly playing to the emotions of my country and its feeling that the world is ganging up on us, and therefore we've got to stand up for ourselves.
In other words, he couldn't deliver on the economic promises, and therefore he distracts from that by saying it's really the outside world.
He did deliver on his economic promises. He literally did deliver on his economic promises. This is just, I mean, so much gaslighting. So much gaslighting in this interview. You know, don't forget, it was this shithead who led who was part of the ruling class that led to the 2008 financial crisis, which we've never recovered from, by the way. So anyway, let's carry on.
World that's coming to get us, and it's their fault.
Correct.
You say you're now afraid he's heading into a third Putin. What is that third Putin like? Or may have already had there.
Detached from reality. I mean, when people say, well, they got bad intelligence about Ukraine or bad intelligence about the European reaction. You know, I said to people, you could have sent some tourists from Russia to Ukraine. They could have come back and told you that they weren't going to greet this with happiness.
Right.
And that they're going to fight.
So why is it then that many, many generals and Ukrainian troops have wanted to surrender and have been told by Zelensky's government that they're under no circumstances are they allowed to surrender? Why is it that Zelensky stopped people escaping and said that males between the ages of 18 and 60 are no longer allowed to leave the country? Why did they have to do those measures if the Ukrainians were so keen on fighting this war? And why is it the case that when Zelensky armed the population, that the population have decided more or less to sit out the conflict, even though they were given weapons to fight it? Could it be that the Zelensky regime is an oligarchical puppet government of a corrupt ruling class that you represent, Tony Blair? Maybe. Let's carry on.
to preserve their country. And mm-hmm. by the way, the Russians should know that, if anyone knows that. I mean, Russians and Ukrainians are very close. There's masses of family ties between the two groups of people. So you've got to be detached from reality. And it's an interesting thing about democracy. So I think there are two things that are happening in the world today, which are, you know, things that show you that why democracy is good. Mm. There are lots of things that have happened in the last 10, 15 years that show you why democracy's got its problems. But the two things that show you why democracy can be good are the invasion of Ukraine, because if you had a system of...
As if Ukraine was a model democracy before Putin invaded. They literally overthrew the previous president in 2014. Oh, tell you what. I'm just going to let him talk because I'm getting really annoyed watching him at this point. He, for some reason, this interview was getting to me, that the level of gaslighting and lies coming from this man's mouth.
Challenge around Putin. Mm-hmm. If he hadn't been there for all that time, surrounding himself with people, just tell him what he wants to hear, he would never have done anything mm-hmm. like this. And the second is the Chinese zero COVID policy.
Right.
Which again, if you had a system of challenge, someone would be saying, this is not a good idea. You can't do this. It's not going to work.
So he's detached. Putin is detached from reality. And you think it's because, or you suspect that the people around him aren't giving him honest assessments of things, that he is unwilling to hear it. Perhaps he has detached himself, isolated himself because of COVID. That's a lot of...
What Blair is saying is that Putin is surrounded by people that don't agree with him, that don't agree with Tony Blair. Putin is surrounded by people who also think the invasion of Ukraine was justified and that Russian security interests are justified. That's what he's saying. Oh, why isn't Vladimir Putin surrounded by people who agree with us? What sort of point is that to make? Who sitting around fucking Joe Biden and Boris Johnson have a different opinion, genuinely? Who in the democratic ruling class of the West actually dares to disagree with them? If you disagree, you're no platformed. You're fired from your job. Your bank account is closed. You're not allowed to have a different opinion from Tony Blair and his friends. So this point that he's making about democracy, showing that, there'll be a different view, is utter trash. Not a single person in the fucking Washington establishment listened to John Mearsheimer, did they? That there isn't a John Mearsheimer acolyte sitting around the table advising Joe Biden and his crony friends. So this is just utter bollocks. Also, when Tony Blair was in government, he didn't listen to anyone other than his closest advisors, which we talked about. Do you remember the sofa politics? The fact that he didn't allow the cabinet into those meetings? The fact that he made executive decisions? Again, this is just pure friend enemy. And to also mention Carl Schmitt, decisionism, which is executive action and he who decides the exception, is exactly what Tony Blair did when he was in power, and it's exactly what Vladimir Putin is doing when he's in power. But, you know, it's good when Tony does it, it's bad when Putin does it. That's all he's giving us here. The sheer chutzpah of the man is really incredible.
Speculation, right?
Yeah, you can speculate, but the one thing you can be sure of is that this was a massive miscalculation.
Right.
He can't be sitting there. I mean, I think he has adjusted his strategy. They now retreated from trying to topple the government and put in a Kremlin client government. Mm-hmm. They've retreated to this, which is very dangerous.
Zelensky is an empire of lies client government, though. This is what they'll never admit, that the Zelensky regime is a client regime of the gay, installed by the gay. Oh, it's just... Oh, I might emigrate to Russia. I won't really.
Just for us, I think this southern corridor and around the Donbass and maybe up towards Transnistria and Moldova, that's their strategy now. Right. But even that is going to be incredibly difficult to accomplish. And he's lost more troops in a couple of months than the British and the Americans lost in the whole of our engagement in the Afghanistan and Iraq.
Right. Well, let me just real quickly on Iraq. A lot of your critics would say, what right do we have to lecture because we went, the United States and Britain went into Iraq? Isn't that not that different than what Putin has done in Ukraine? Didn't we set the precedent for this? Aren't you responsible for this, or at least giving them a justification?
So,
you always know, by the way, when Blair is a little bit mildly irritated with the interviewer, because he gives that little laugh. It's another Blair tell, right? The little grin and laugh he gives, that's Blair saying, you fucking don't come with that again. I'm going to give this a brush off. You dare do that again, and I'll go to your boss and I'll get you fired in the morning.
My attitude to this, even if you're completely against what we did in Iraq or indeed in Afghanistan, you've got to push back hard against this argument. Removing Saddam Hussein, who after all started two regional wars, killed hundreds of thousands of people, including 12,000 people by chemical weapons in one day in Halabja, and who his people definitely wanted rid of, is not the same as going into a country that's never caused any problem to its neighbors, has got a democratically elected president, and trying to topple them. So even if you...
It's good when we do it, it's bad when they do it. It's the same answer he gave to The Economist, if you remember. This is his set piece answer, and it's like, don't fucking go there again, Ben, or whatever your name is.
Completely disagree with what we did. The two situations are not in... They're not in any shape or form similar, really, when you think about it and analyze it.
You said the defining question of 21st century geopolitics would be the West's relationship with China, which obviously has a great deal to do with what's happening in Europe as well. Many of our readers are asking questions like Kubsak from Bangkok and Howard from Maryland, who are asking, what do you think that new geopolitics looks like? What do you think that the Ukraine war has shown us about how the world might best respond to any potential aggression by China when it comes to Taiwan?
So I think what the West needs, and this Ukraine conflict is an opportunity for it to become a pivot point for Western policy. And it's a very overused word, this, but the West needs a strategy for its relationship with the world. In other words, by strategy, I mean a thought-out, coherent plan in which in every aspect of what it's doing, it knows and can define what its strategy is, right? And that's different from a series of spasmodic reactions to whatever's happening in the world. So with China, my view is you need strength plus engagement, right? You need strength because you've got to be strong enough so that in whatever direction this Chinese regime goes, and you know, we know it's become internally more oppressive, externally more aggressive, strength to ensure whatever happens, you're able to deal with it and if necessary to overcome it. But engagement, because China's not the Soviet Union and China's not Russia. You know, China, by dint of its population, its economy, its technology, its civilization, is and should be a big world power. You know, our desire should not be to try and prevent China becoming a major power, right? It will become a major power. And I think it's a big mistake to try and force countries, as it were, to choose between their relationship between America and China, because they just won't in many different parts of the world. But you've got to be strong enough to ensure, and this is why the West has got to build its capabilities, and you could be strong enough to deal with China, whatever happens, you've got to build your capabilities. And then, for example, I could go round the world and tell you where the West hasn't got a strategy. We've not got a strategy, I don't think, a really coherent one for the Middle East anymore. I don't...
Bit of moonlighting from Blair, by the way. I could go round the world. If you pay me millions of dollars, I'll come to a country near you and tell you how to run your local strategy. It's very funny, this. But yes, let's carry on.
I think we've got a coherent strategy in relation to Africa, where China's presence is enormous. Russia's presence, by the way, has been growing significantly in the last decade. You know, the West is hopelessly bureaucratic when it comes to dealing with these countries. They would prefer to deal with us, by the way. But they just find they can't, because they can't attract the investment they want in from the West, because our rules are now very, very constrained around investment in Africa. They can't get our help in aid and development without a bureaucratic process a lot of them find disabling. So it's, you go around the world today, my view is the West has got to have a strategy. And one of the reasons for that, and it's got a very specific China dimension to it, the Chinese have come to the view, wrongly, but they've come to the view that the West is decadent. In other words, decaying, in the literal sense of the word.
They've come to the view correctly that the West is decaying and decadent. It is a correct assessment that anybody can see. Let's see how Tony Blair counters this.
You've got to show them that's not true, because that will have its own reverberative effect inside the Chinese system. I mean, even though Xi Jinping appears in total control, underneath the surface there will be all sorts of debates and tensions. He's got to know, the Chinese government's got to know, the West isn't decaying. We believe in our value system.
It is decaying, and nobody really believes in your value system. Nobody does. That's why we need to clear these twats out, because their worldview is insane.
We're prepared to stand up for it and stand up for our interests. And we do, I suggest that.
Listen, Pete, Johnny come latelys, I explained the audio situation already. I can't get this up any higher, I'm afraid. All I can do is put my microphone back a bit further so that me and Blair are at the same level. How's that? Okay, let's try that.
Not in order to be aggressive towards China, but in order to limit any possibility of miscalculation on their part.
Right, right. Well, we talk about the West. What even qualifies as the West these days? I mean, like, is Turkey part of the West? Is Hungary part of the West? Are we so fraying ourselves in that sense that we can't define a strategy for the rest of the world because we can't define a strategy for ourselves?
Well, it's a good point, Peter, but I think you can define a core. You know, America, European Union, the democracies of the world. I think you can define a core. Other countries where, you can't be sure whether they qualify or not, yes. But that core is strong. Even if you take America and Europe, if America and Europe are standing together, they're very powerful.
In that strategy you're talking about, in effect, that seems to come to President Biden, right? Because in the end, who's going to centralize, who's going to lead a multitude of powers to come up with a coherent strategy, and that would normally follow the American president. I mean, President Trump obviously tried to blow up in some ways the Western alliance. He obviously was anti-NATO in a lot of ways. President Biden is not. But is he showing the leadership you want to see from him in defining what you're talking about, a broader strategy to the rest of the world?
Well, I think this moment is potentially a pivoting moment. And to be fair to him, he has brought Europe and America together. Mm-hmm. And even if you see, you know, just a few days ago, you know, bringing together a whole lot of the countries in our alliance at the NATO base in Germany, and working out exactly what weaponry and how we support the Ukrainians. I think nothing can happen without American leadership. And one of the biggest anxieties I have had in the last few years is I'm saying this with delicacy because it's not my politics, it's your politics. So I don't want to tell you what to do in your own country. But your polarization, the polarization of your politics, the profound kind of dysfunction that has led to, I think is a big problem. It's a big problem for the West. Now, I believe in the end that...
Very telling. Now, this is straight from the World Economic Forum. This is how they're thinking as well. They're worried about quote-unquote polarization. That is why ultimately I think they're going to try to bring Trump back into the fold. They need to. For the empire to survive, they need to bring Democrats and Republicans back together somehow. They need to. Biden, you know, okay, he's managed to bring Europe and America together in this coalition, but he has not managed to heal the kind of disunity on the domestic front. So I do think that efforts are going to be made behind the scenes to bring Trump in somehow.
It can be resolved. I hope it's resolved. But there can't be any strong Western leadership without strong American leadership.
Do you think that the debacle of the withdrawal from Afghanistan, whether you thought it was a good idea or not to get out, that the way it was handled empowered, emboldened, and encouraged people like Putin to think that the West is in fact decaying and not capable of exerting itself on the world stage?
Look, as you know, I wasn't in favor of doing it or the way it was done. I think it's been an accumulation of things. But on the other hand, you know, I think it's quite important to state that the most significant element in all of this has been inside Putin's head. Mm-hmm. Have we sent signals of weakness? Yes, I think we have. But obviously, in the end, it was his decision.
Yeah. Talk about Britain for a second, United Kingdom. You know, the sanctions on Russia have highlighted again what we all knew, but that how much London and Britain have been a safe haven for Russian oligarchs and money. And I wonder whether you feel like, in hindsight, that there is some complicity there in propping up an authoritarian regime in the way that London and the United Kingdom welcomed that money, as dirty as some of it might have been.
Yeah, I think you've got to distinguish between two things. I mean, I think the actions that have been taken just in these last few years to tighten the system up are completely right. I think it's important to get it in context. I mean, yes, there are Russian oligarchs that have come to the UK. They've come to many different parts of the world. I think, you know, there have been some very high profile cases of oligarchs in the UK, but I wouldn't, you know, when people say, well, the City of London was dependent on Russian money, I mean, no, you go and work out the figures. It's nothing like that. But in any event, that is being unraveled now.
Mm-hmm. What should be?
He just didn't answer the question because they were the oligarchs that Putin threw out and you took them in. Tone. Don't you remember? What a fucking snake. Such a snake.
What should be Britain's approach to that going forward? I mean, in other words, you put up a sign saying, no thanks, we don't want you anymore. You're out of here.
Well, I think you've got to distinguish between money that's coming in that is, as you just described it, is dirty money, mm-hmm. and money that is coming in.
Right.
I mean, I'm not against money coming into London. I like money coming into London. I was used to encourage it when I was Prime Minister. But obviously, you shouldn't have money that's coming in which is in breach of...
Friend good, enemy bad. Enemy money dirty, friend money good. But those oligarchs that Putin threw out were friends. So that was good money. That's basically what you're saying in a nutshell.
You know, money laundering. But I don't think Britain's really... I think the number of cases where there's actually, you know, illegal money has found its home in the UK are pretty small. There are other places in the world it's going.
Mm-hmm. I should mention, by the way, that question also came from readers Craig in Maine and Anne in Rhode Island, just to make clear. it's notable that a number of countries have not...
Just to make clear, Tony, in case you have words with my boss later on, because I asked you that question, it didn't come from me, it came from a viewer. Just so I don't get fired in the morning. That's why he threw that in.
Chosen to back the West and in its pushing back against Russia, Mexico, Brazil, India, and so forth. What does that tell you right now about the ability to exercise that leadership we're talking about? Is there a reason why they're not condemning this action the way others have?
So I think you've got to literally go around each set of countries and work out what their reasons are. So for some countries, they've got a close dependency on Russia.
Yeah.
Some of them because, for example, I was in Africa last week. Some of the countries there, over 50% of their wheat's coming from Russia. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're in a difficult situation. For a country like Israel, they've got this need to operate within the Syrian airspace, which is controlled by Russia. In the case of India, they get half their weapon systems from Russia. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, the numbers of countries that are truly supportive of what Russia's doing. I mean, they're pretty much a roll call of the mad and the bad, aren't they?
Right.
Right. So I think for other countries, they've usually got specific reasons. But what I favor is, in rather than criticizing them, try and understand what those reasons are. You know, try and understand, for example, why there are countries in the Middle East, in the Gulf, who felt they weren't given proper support after the attacks on them. You know, try and see it from the point of view of the Indians, who need weapon systems because they believe they have a threat from China.
From Pakistan, isn't it, as well, Tone? Yeah? It's not just from China, it's from Pakistan, yeah?
Part of what I'm calling Western strategy is to make sure that we're building equities, not just defense equities, but business, investment, ties with these countries that mean that when you call upon them, they're likely to respond. And it's a really important point, this, when they call upon us, we're not telling them we've got other business to take care of and we can't be bothered.
Right. We're going to wrap this up here, but we have one last question. You mentioned Israel, and you spent a lot of time in the Middle East peace efforts, and you just said that you feel like the West doesn't have a strategy right now in the Middle East. I mean, from our reader and our chief European correspondent, Steve Erlinger, he'd like to know a little bit more about what you think the policy should be right now in terms of Israel and Palestine, especially at the time when this Abraham's Accord obviously has produced a good thing with relations between Arab and Arab states and Israel, but it also marginalizes the Palestinians. It puts them, off the map, in effect, because we no longer need to concern ourselves with them. What is your feeling about where things are now?
Right. So we could take another half an hour or an hour on this, but let me give you just two points that I think are important. The first is, I think partly because of the state of Palestinian politics, there isn't a way you can get an Israeli-Palestinian peace process mm-hmm. of any meaningful sort happening. But I do think in the end, the key to resolving the Palestinian issue is the Israeli-Arab relationship. Mm-hmm. The closer they are, the more they work together, the more Israel will feel it's comfortable enough in the region to make peace. And hopefully in time, a Palestinian leadership emerges that understands the only way of getting peace with Israel is to make it clear that you're in favor of the state of Israel and not hostile to it. Mm-hmm. Okay. The second thing that I think is really important, and I constantly say this to Western policymakers.
Surrender, in other words. The Palestinians have to surrender.
because of the amount of time I spend in the Middle East. The battle in the Middle East today is not between Israelis and Arabs, Persians and Arabs, Sunni and Shia. It's a battle around whether the societies there can become religiously tolerant and open-minded, free from an abusive relationship with religion, and whether they can go towards what I call rule-based economies, where if people work hard and do well, they can build their business, they can help develop the economy. And across the Middle East, there are forces of modernization and moderation, and there.
I mean, he's literally saying the only way to understand the Middle East is to see it purely through a Western lens. You know, as long as Muslim nations become more like us, that's a good thing. But if they continue to try to, live according to their local customs and laws and their own way of doing things, that's bad. That's abusive. It's actually an abusive relationship with religion to do it that way. You actually need to be much more like the Empire of Lies, because liberal democracy is the true religion of the world. That's what you just said, essentially.
There are forces of what I would call regressive and reactionary politics, usually based on this Islamist concept rather than respect for Islam, Islamism turning it into a political ideology. And if you want to know where the Western policy should be, it should be to get behind those forces of modernization and moderation and to isolate the others.
Well, thank you very much, Tony Blair, for joining us today. We really appreciate your taking the time.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you.
And thank you to our readers for tuning in today into our New York Times.
Thanks, Peter. You won't get fired in the morning because you made sure you let the Dark Lord know it wasn't you asking the questions. All right, let's see if there's any super chats and we'll get out of here. So have a look at entropy. None in there. And then we'll just have a quick look in the main super chats. Yeah, there's a couple. Dilla98 says, loving the content, AA. Started watching your old live streams, and three of my favorites are the number 100 episode of UO, Theresa May resigning, and Pottery Rights. Pottery Rights, the old debate with Ray Murasami. It's one of the, I think it's one of the cigar streams, actually. I think this cigar stream 13, I want to say, is Pottery Rights. Cepheus99 says, is Blair warrior, priest, or merchant? He's a priest in service of the merchants, is what Tony Blair is. A priest in service of the merchants. Definitely not a warrior. Scott Patrick says, AA, is it your opinion that Tony Blair is an Arpatric, a mere puppet of Don the Pleb? No, it is not my opinion. I don't think Don the Pleb and Tony Blair would agree on very much. All right, that'll do for this stream. We'll be back tomorrow with The Deepest Law, where we should have an announcement about a new course on the academic agency, a very exciting new course, not written by me, written by, well, we'll leave it as a surprise. Yes, so buy that and all the other courses on the academic agency. Join the channel if you want those old streams that were mentioned. Buy a mug, get my book, The Populist Illusion, join my Substack, but most importantly of all, get out.